You're listening to First Stop the New Hampshire Primary, a special issue of Historical New Hampshire published in 2003 by the New Hampshire Historical Society.
He's My Man, Sherman Adams and New Hampshire's Role in the Draft Eisenhower Movement by Michael J. Berkner. On presidential primary day, March 11, 1952, wet snow fell steadily over much of New Hampshire, and campaign managers became anxious about getting out their vote. Governor Sherman Adams, manager of the Draft Eisenhower campaign, had a lot riding on a primary that President Harry Truman had dismissed as little more than eyewash. By all evidence, Americans wanted change in Washington. The New Hampshire primary results would surely influence the making of a president. Adams knew there was only one thing to do: stop worrying about the weather and start moving his people to the polls. Spotting a winner. During the summer of 1951, a contrasting scenario faced the flinty chief executive of the Granite State. Sherman Adams was known for his determination to control events rather than let events control him. But that summer, Adams was at loose ends. The zest he had brought to office in 1949 and the reformist vigor of the first 3 years of his tenure were largely spent. That summer, moreover, Adams had suffered a humbling legislative rejection of his proposed plan to institute a broad-based tax. A modest sales tax, Adams had argued, would provide the foundation for the kinds of improvements to roads, schools, and other public institutions that he believed were necessary to modernize New Hampshire and to bring its educational system on a par with those of neighbors such as Vermont and Massachusetts. Adams' efforts, however, were to no avail. The same interests and politicians who had foiled his earlier broad-based tax plans in 1949 resurfaced, better organized and more effective this time around. With the defeat of his bill in the Assembly by a 2-to-1 margin, in part engineered by foes within his own party, Adams was taunted as a failed taxer and a lame duck governor, jibes that cut all the deeper because Adams knew that they were true. New Hampshire had a two-term tradition, and a governor who failed repeatedly to advance the central element of his own state modernization program was unlikely to get another chance. Adams had no plan for himself beyond the governor's office. He could not expect a lucrative position in the timber industry, the business he knew best, because logging in the Northeast, notably in his beloved Pemigewasset region, was in a terminal decline. The United States Senate was not an option, with two popular incumbents, Charles Toby and Stiles Bridges, showing no interest in abandoning their posts. Adams' main hope was in national politics, hitching his star to a presidential candidate who might offer him an office that would be challenging and remunerative. That was a long shot, but it was the only shot he had. The problem for Sherman Adams in the summer of 1951 was that he had no horse to ride for the upcoming presidential campaign. Two nationally prominent figures had expressed interest in the GOP nomination. The conservative Ohio Senator Robert A. Taft, known as Mr. Republican, was the son of former President and Supreme Court Chief Justice William Howard Taft. Senator Taft had recently stirred a political hornet's nest by arguing that the United States should disengage from the defense of Western Europe, and also ran in 1948 former Minnesota Governor Harold Stassen, known for his steadfast internationalism, offered a possible alternative to Taft. Neither man radiated the political appeal that said, winner. Senator Taft had made an exploratory visit to New Hampshire in the spring of 1951, taking the state's political temperature and touching base with state leaders, including Governor Adams. In late August, Taft made another brief tour, addressing legislators in joint session at the Capitol and attending two Republican dinners in Hampton. As a courtesy, Adams had driven Taft from Concord to the seacoast and graciously introduced him at one of his speeches. Yet Adams remained steadfastly noncommittal about an endorsement. A supporter of the Atlantic Alliance and of an assertive American presence in world affairs, Adams was troubled by Taft's quasi-isolationism, but he was more concerned that Taft lacked voter appeal. As he told state legislator Robert A. Johnson in the summer of 1951, when Johnson listed all of Taft's virtues as a senator, "I agree with you, but how in the world are you going to elect him?" In Adams' view, and in the view of other Republicans, including some steadfast conservatives, a Taft race against Democratic incumbent Harry Truman would likely drag the GOP down to an unprecedented sixth straight defeat. It was a prospect that depressed Adams and many other Republicans nationwide. For them, the election of 1952 was too important to go along with a potential nominee just because he was smart or principled. They wanted to win. As Taft solicited support for his candidacy in New Hampshire and throughout the nation, a band of Eastern Republicans who shared Adams' concerns began recruiting an alternative they believed had the aura of a winner. General of the Army Dwight D. Eisenhower, based in Paris and commander of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO. Senators Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts and James Duff of Pennsylvania, New York Governor Thomas E. Dewey, Congressman Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania, Christian Herter of Massachusetts, and Norris Cotton of New Hampshire, among other GOP leaders, could read polls as well as anyone. The polls showed that Taftite Republicanism was unpopular. In November 1948, conservative Republicans had supported the Dewey-Warren ticket against President Harry Truman. Americans were indeed worried about the trend toward creeping socialism, but not to the point of ending popular programs such as Social Security, Tennessee Valley Authority, or farm subsidies. Polls also indicated that most voters, particularly the millions of World War II veterans, opposed isolationism. As one young Republican later put it, he and many other fellow veterans wanted individual initiative, but they also wanted the U.S. to be very much involved in what was going on in the world. For victory-hungry Republicans, Robert A. Taft was too familiar and too rigidly conservative to meet the needs of a changing world. Eisenhower, by contrast, was a made-to-order candidate, tested in the crucible of war, vivacious, with a winning smile. In pollsters' surveys conducted in 1951, Ike fared well against incumbent President Harry Truman, especially among non-union working men who usually voted Democratic, but found Eisenhower's candidacy appealing. But would Ike run? And was he even a Republican? At his Paris headquarters, Eisenhower kept his intentions to himself as he entertained a steady stream of Republicans visiting to remind him that he was the party's best hope. Eisenhower listened patiently to each of them, often nodding, as they bemoaned ethical lapses in the Truman administration and a general decline in moral standards in the United States. Yet Ike made no commitments. As he told Norris Cotton and Robert Burroughs, the latter a successful Manchester businessman and GOP stalwart, "The United States is full of politicians, many of them good ones, who love the public attention and publicity and all the reporters and flashbulbs. Let them have it. I have had enough of that kind of thing." Still, Eisenhower made no definitive statements removing himself from consideration for the presidency. Moreover, he told those who visited him in Paris what he had said to Senator Henry Cabot Lodge in a 1950 meeting, in which Lodge had urged Ike to run for president. Ike replied that he was uninterested in party politics, but added, "A man who definitely has a public duty to perform and doesn't perform it is in the same category as Benedict Arnold." Did Ike acknowledge he had such a duty? The fact that he spent many hours with those who were trying to persuade him to run suggested that if a genuine draft emerged, his mind was open to a candidacy. We want Ike. As the leaves began changing in late September 1951, Chairman Adams enjoyed a golf outing with his old friend and political ally, Chairman of the Republican State Committee, Richard Cooper. Between golf shots, Cooper told Adams of his concern about Taft as a potential GOP nominee, and further, how he thought the party's best hope for success was Eisenhower. Adams agreed enthusiastically, "Well, he's my man, and he'll win it." Chairman Adams had found the antidote to his summer malaise, a candidate and a cause to which, for better or worse, he would hitch his star. Several days after the conversation with Dick Cooper, Adams caused a stir at the Republican governor's meeting in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, by declaring that he expected Eisenhower to accept a draft for the GOP nomination, and that he was confident Ike would win both the nomination and the election in 1952. Adams was not yet ready to endorse Eisenhower formally, but reporters grasped that the governor was expressing not only an opinion, but also a meaningful preference. During the fall of 1951, as Adams began assembling an Eisenhower organization in New Hampshire, a group of leading Eastern Republicans, notably Duff, Lodge, Dewey, Scott, former Dewey campaign manager Herbert Brownell, and retired General Lucius Clay, then president of the Continental Can Company, launched a national Eisenhower for President committee. In late October, their efforts were buoyed by an emphatic endorsement by the New York Herald Tribune, probably the most influential voice of the GOP establishment. The next step was to take the draft movement on the road. Burly Jim Duff, a former Pennsylvania governor serving his first and only Senate term, was a whirlwind of activity on behalf of Eisenhower. He spoke in all corners of the country, wherever he could wangle an invitation, spreading a message that was powerful in its simplicity. Only Ike could defeat the Democrats in 1952. Like Duff, Senator Lodge was indefatigable on the stump, offering essentially the same message, leavened by an emphasis on the need to reject isolationism and avoid reactionary appeals to the electorate. Lodge had the added responsibility of coordinating the growing array of Eisenhower committees nationwide, of which none was more critical to the cause than New Hampshire. A public duty to perform. Sherman Adams had proven his ability as an organizer many times in the past. As a logging crew chief and general manager for the Parker Young Company in the White Mountains, as a candidate for the state legislature and for Congress, and as a hands-on, reform-minded governor. Now Adams had another challenge. Between November 1951 and March 1952, Adams's responsibilities as governor took a back seat to his role as field marshal of the Eisenhower campaign in New Hampshire. Early in November, Adams and New Hampshire State Committeeman Frank Soloway recruited a cadre of about 30 New Hampshire political leaders and activists for an Eisenhower Night event in Concord. Encouraged by the response, indeed amazed by the range of prominent personalities who showed interest in Ike, Adams scheduled an Eisenhower rally for November 24 at Concord's Legion Hall. Robert Burrows and Adams assured 120 Republicans who showed up that Eisenhower would not reject a draft. "Eisenhower will have his name on the March 11 ballot," Adams declared. "He will not withdraw his name from our presidential primary. Of that, I am now certain." Why he was so sure, Adams did not say, but his confidence had much to do with assurances from Lodge, Duff, and Burrows, each of whom had been in regular contact with the general in France. In preparation for the November 24 event, Adams helped write a platform, emphasizing the need to elect a man of demonstrated capacity to deal successfully in matters of world importance, and citing the need to clean up widespread corruption in Washington. Foreign affairs were not ignored. "We need capable and effective leadership, while we and our neighbors still possess the determination and the economic strength effectively to resist and counteract aggression. That need is imperative. It demands fulfillment now." Within days of the Concord rally, a large and enthusiastic Eisenhower gathering was held in Manchester, with Senator Duff as the featured speaker. Meanwhile, an executive committee of New Hampshire Eisenhower supporters was established in Concord, meeting daily at 10 a.m. in a basement room at Republican headquarters on Main Street. Manchester's Burrows handled fundraising, while Concord Monitor editor James Langley assumed responsibility for publicity, a role he played with much relish and effectiveness in subsequent weeks. The Monitor soon emerged as cheerleader for the Eisenhower campaign. At the same time, the Manchester Union leader pulled out all stops on behalf of Taft. Where does Eisenhower stand? Successful presidential campaigns follow a recipe that has not varied dramatically during the 20th century: effective organization, money to promote the candidate, and some indefinable match between what the candidate offers and what the voters seek. In 1952, all the pieces fell into place for the Eisenhower campaign, though hindsight makes the result seem more inevitable than it felt or was at the time. 1 week before the rally in Concord's Legion Hall, a national Eisenhower campaign, managed by Senator Lodge, formally launched its own effort. For Adams in New Hampshire, Senator Lodge, and other Eisenhower supporters, the immediate concern was to get Eisenhower's name on the Republican primary ballot in New Hampshire. There was a catch, however. In order to put Eisenhower on the ballot, his supporters had to provide evidence that he was a Republican. Consequently, Adams directed his Attorney General, Gordon Tiffany, to inquire if the polling records in Abilene, Kansas, indicated any affiliation with the Kansas GOP. C.F. Moore, the county clerk in Dickinson County, wrote back promptly, typing his reply on the letter he had received from New Hampshire, indicating that he could find no record of Eisenhower voting in this county since 1927 when Moore had become the clerk. He added a memorable obiter dictum. Dwight's father was a Republican and always voted the Republican ticket until his death. However, that has nothing to do with the son, as many differ from their fathers, of which I am sorry to see. The multitude believes in going into debt and see how much they can spend. It has become a habit and will sink this nation into bankruptcy. I don't think he has any politics. This was not promising, but fortunately for Ike's supporters, it was not the last word. Lacking a documentary record of Ike's allegiance to the GOP, Adams turned to Senator Lodge, the draft Eisenhower movement spokesman, and asked what he could do to cut through the confusion and get Ike on record as a committed Republican. Lodge spoke with New York Herald Tribune publisher William Robinson about the problem. When Robinson flew to Europe to spend Christmas with the Eisenhowers, he posed the critical question, would Ike allow his name on the Republican presidential ballot in New Hampshire? The answer, as Robinson explained to Lodge when he returned to New York the next day, was affirmative. Army regulations made it impossible for Ike to undertake political activity, but he did not object to the steps the draft Eisenhower movement took to enter him in the primary. Lodge then wrote Adams, authorizing him to proceed with his efforts on behalf of Ike, and followed with a Sunday morning press conference in Washington on January 6, announcing that the draft Eisenhower movement was going full speed ahead. As Lodge later recalled, the news coverage given to the letter to Governor Adams surpassed all our expectations. It dominated the front pages for 3 days. Choosing sides. With this major obstacle now surmounted, Adams began assembling a slate of delegates he believed could attract votes in New Hampshire for the absent candidate. On January 11, the opening filing date for the primary, Adams led a delegation of the office of Secretary of State Enoch Fuller and filed personally as a delegate candidate for Ike. Notables joining him on the list included Congressman Norris Cotton, former Governor Robert Blood, Concord lawyer and former Congressman Foster Stearns, and GOP State Committeeman Frank Sulloway. Sulloway and Blood were particularly significant, as Taft backers had counted on their support for the Ohioan. Complementing this ticket of political veterans was a group of newer party people brought in to balance the delegate slate. They included AFL leader Basil French of Manchester, Phillips Exeter Academy headmaster William Saltonstall, and young attorneys Ralph Langdell and Stanley Brown. Adams, according to one source, was the chief coordinator and engineer behind the coalition. Because Eisenhower issued no statement disavowing a candidacy by the end of the filing period, January 27, he was at last officially on the ballot. Meanwhile, Taft activists were also plotting strategy. Wesley Powell, a former aide to Senator Bridges and a young attorney who had come within a hair of unseating Senator Toby in a hard-fought GOP primary in 1950, met with Senator Taft in Washington on January 11, imploring Taft to contest the Eisenhower slate in New Hampshire. Taft responded by sending Philadelphia lawyer John Hamilton, a former GOP national chairman, as his emissary to Concord for several days in mid-January, while awaiting the results of a postcard poll commissioned by the Taft organization. Based at the Eagle Hotel in Concord, Hamilton conferred with leading Taft backers, among them National Committeeman Robert Upton of Concord and his son Frederick, Judge George Griffin of Lincoln, Frederick Ted Johnson, a key figure in Manchester GOP politics, Manchester Union Leader publisher William Loeb, and others. As late as January 20, the Taft campaign had no organization in place, and Taft himself had not committed to enter the state's first-in-the-nation primary. Based on his correspondence and conversations with political activists, Hamilton, however, concluded that campaigning for delegates in New Hampshire was a calculated risk worth taking. He assured Taft that should he win, the Eisenhower candidacy would suffer a complete collapse. Yet nowhere in his long memo to Taft did Hamilton lay out a workable strategy for winning. He did say, however, that gaining Senator Stiles Bridges' endorsement would be invaluable. Hamilton conceded that polls currently favored Eisenhower, but concluded nonetheless that Taft would at worst run within 4 percentage points of Eisenhower, and that even if defeated in the beauty contest, Taft would surely pick up 3 or 4 delegates. With the encouragement of Hamilton and other correspondents who maintained he could win the New Hampshire primary, Taft agreed at the last hour to toss his hat in the ring. Filing for delegates favorable to Taft soon followed. Missing from the list of delegate candidates on either side were the state's Republican senators. Charles Tobey, a Yankee progressive, was ardently pro-Eisenhower. But as he explained to Sherman Adams, the recent death of his wife left him overwhelmed in my sense of grief and loneliness. And he believed it unwise to run in his current frame of mind. He added, though, that he would do whatever he could for the Eisenhower campaign. Senator Tobey was as good as his word, writing numerous letters and issuing manifold statements on behalf of Eisenhower in the campaign that followed. Charles Tobey was popular in New Hampshire, but he was a political maverick and lacked an effective organization. By contrast, Stiles Bridges had the best political organization in the state. Consequently, Bridges' failure to endorse his friend surprised many observers and frustrated Senator Taft. Precisely why Bridges chose to proclaim neutrality between Taft and Eisenhower, despite his alignment with Taft on all the major domestic and foreign policy issues of the time, is unclear. Bridges' explanation that he was too busy as Senate Minority Leader to participate in the campaign was not the full story. A canny political operator who always tried to stay a step ahead of any potential opposition, Bridges knew that Eisenhower had a good chance to win the New Hampshire primary. He not only did not want to antagonize the general, but he wanted also to avoid giving ammunition to potential political opposition. Several of Bridges' former aides, including Wes Powell and Louis Wyman, worked hard for Taft, provoking comment that Bridges was behind the scenes pulling strings on the Ohioans' behalf. To Robert Taft's exasperation, it was not so. Bridges' actions were as neutral as his public statements. Harold Stassen and General Douglas MacArthur also entered the race in early 1952, but neither gained much traction in New Hampshire. The effort by political amateurs from out of state to promote MacArthur was so inept that the general sent a letter on February 5 instructing his backers not to proceed. Stassen, unable to round up a delegate slate, filed only for the beauty contest portion of the primary, in part, as he told Henry Cabot Lodge, to keep his name in national stories, cartoons, and comment in the period leading up to the New Hampshire primary. No doubt, Stassen also hoped that a better-than-expected showing in New Hampshire, especially if Taft defeated Eisenhower in the primary poll, would set him up as the main progressive alternative to the Ohioan for the GOP nomination. For his part, MacArthur never set foot in New Hampshire before the primary. Stassen did, but it was evident from his lack of organization and the small crowds he attracted that most voters were focused on the contest between Taft and Eisenhower. Sounding the call. The Eisenhower forces enjoyed significant advantages, notably in generating publicity for their candidate. The Manchester Union Leader promoted Taft on both its news and editorial pages. Most regional dailies and weeklies, however, whether or not they openly favored Ike, published a steady stream of pro-Eisenhower news releases generated by Adams's team. Among the most ardent champions of Eisenhower was the Concord Monitor, whose editor, James Langley, published a passel of opinion pieces declaring Ike electable and Taft not. Each afternoon in February and early March 1952, Langley also held court in the bar of the Eagle Hotel, where, according to one associate, the editor gave the lowdown to national reporters about just what Eisenhower was going to do to Taft come primary day. In addition to support from the local press, Eisenhower forces had ample funds to build a strong statewide organization and to publicize their candidate on the radio and in the papers. Numerous contributions from out of state, most notably from Texas and New York City, poured into the Eisenhower campaign, though Adams buried this fact in a private report of the campaign budget that he drew up after the March balloting. The Eisenhower campaign's Central Committee provided whatever funds were needed to stage a rally or to underwrite a speaker. The Taft campaign, by contrast, ran on a relative shoestring. As Taft frequently reminded audiences, his connections were to Main Street, not Wall Street. This was a useful talking point during speeches, but it did not provide the wherewithal to underwrite campaign posters, ads, and get out the vote money on primary day. Still, the Taft campaign was able to convey its message in a variety of media, and Taft ads were featured prominently in most of the state's daily and weekly newspapers. Taft's prospects for victory, it was widely believed, hinged on a campaign swing by the senator planned for the climactic final week of the primary campaign. Sherman Adams was the key figure in the Eisenhower primary effort. He was constantly on the phone and on the move, writing letters to operatives telling them about individuals who could be won over with the right appeal, giving speeches at numerous rallies across the state, plotting tactics, and keeping the national campaign abreast of developments in New Hampshire. As one close observer later recalled, Adams was the drummer boy up front sounding the call. He was the center of the force as it gathered momentum, and he was the man at the end of the procession, ready to urge on any who faltered. Adams's determination to work night and day for Eisenhower was fueled by his awareness that a defeat in New Hampshire would almost certainly lead Eisenhower to disavow interest in a draft for the GOP nomination. Eisenhower had never said as much to the many politicians who visited him in France during the winter of 1952, but it was evident that the general's understanding of a call to duty did not entail repudiation in an early crucial poll. Certainly, the Eisenhower Brigade in New York and Boston worked on this premise, keeping in touch constantly with Adams, coordinating campaign events, and providing funds as needed. A victory in New Hampshire was essential for both psychological and tactical reasons, and they would do everything legally and physically possible to achieve that result. That included some enjoyable malarkey. When New Hampshire Assembly Speaker Richard Upton wrote the bill establishing a New Hampshire primary, in which voters elected delegates who were pledged to specific presidential candidates, he hoped that the new law would stimulate interest in politics and produce a healthier democracy. Sherman Adams had no problem with Upton's conception, but in 1952 he added a new element to the primary tableau, entertainment. Adams recognized that with Eisenhower in Europe, it would be difficult to get voters to attend mass rallies and other public meetings if the only attraction was political talk. So Adams decided to mix pleasure and politics by injecting showbiz into the primary. To be sure, there was an ample serving of political oratory at all Eisenhower rallies. At almost every event, leading politicians were included on the program, among them national figures such as Senator Lodge, Duff, Frank Carlson of Kansas, or Congressman Clifford Case of New Jersey and Walter Judd of Minnesota. In order to pull in the crowds, Adams shrewdly complemented the requisite political speeches with musicians, jugglers, and other entertainers, perhaps most notably Fred Waring and his Pennsylvanians, a popular swing band.
Come with me and we'll attend their jubilee and see them spend their last two bits.
Music and banter were part of each evening's fair, with New Hampshire's governor himself often center stage. Adams played piano and crooned popular tunes in the interest of warming up the crowd on behalf of General Eisenhower. As an account of Adams' role at a Claremont rally for Ike put it, New Hampshire's Governor Sherman Adams just about stole the show from Fred Waring at Claremont's Eisenhower rally by singing in a cultured baritone his own parody of Danny Deever, the lyrics of which were reworked to satirize ethical lapses during the Truman administration. According to the Boston Evening Globe, 600 persons, many of whom were standing in the aisles of the Claremont City Hall, roared their approval. They had come to hear politics leavened with entertainment. Governor Adams gave them just what they were after, a good hard-hitting dose of politics presented in an entertaining fashion. According to the article, at every mention of Eisenhower, there was a burst of spontaneous clapping from various sections of the floor, which was picked up and carried across the hall like a breaking wave. Not every observer thought Adams' campaign hijinks amusing. An editorial writer for the pro-Taft Portland, Maine Press-Herald grumped that vaudeville had no place in politics. Comedy and choruses, like Adams's parody of Danny Deever, have nothing to do with picking a president of the United States, the writer asserted. It's an insult to the voters, an insult to Eisenhower, and downright disgusting. But Adams paid such critics no heed, as one Republican who watched him play the drums and sing at a large Eisenhower rally in Lancaster put it, "My distinct impression was that Adams was having a gorgeous time." And Adams was making an impact. Those who came to New Hampshire from beyond the state's borders to join the Ike Crusade were consistently impressed by the skill and wisdom and experience in his heart, as one of them, television personality J.R. Tex McCrary, put it in a letter to General Ike. Early in February, Adams traveled to New York to appear on the 1950s equivalent of Good Morning America, the popular Tex and Jinx show featuring the husband and wife broadcasting team of McCrary and his wife, Jinx Falkenberg. McCrary was then orchestrating a huge We Want Ike rally in Madison Square Garden on February 8th. The rally, which Adams and his fellow delegate candidates attended, thanks to the financial help of wealthy New Yorker Nelson A. Rockefeller, was political hokum at its finest. There were a few speeches to the packed house of at least 15,000 Eisenhower supporters. Instead, celebrities offered a serenade for Ike that included Irving Berlin singing his own I Like Ike composition, and Jinx Falkenberg, a former model, actress, and tennis pro, smacking tennis balls to the audience from a boxing ring that was the rostrum for the rally. The point of this political circus was serious. The event's impresario, Tex McCrary, had wanted to show the political world and Eisenhower himself that the public liked Ike and clamored for him to run for the presidency. When a film of the New York rally was flown to Paris by aviatrix Jacqueline Cochran and shown to Eisenhower and Mamie at their temporary quarters, Cochran recalled that Eisenhower burst into tears. Another witness, William Robinson, claimed that once Ike composed himself, he said, "I'm going to run." If the Madison Square rally accomplished its main objectives, it also had the added benefit of providing an adrenaline rush to a hard-driving field general for the New Hampshire Eisenhower effort. Adams put in extraordinary hours, making command decisions about where to hold events, how to spend money, and how best to engage the Taft campaign. Adams wrote dozens of letters soliciting funds and thanking donors, directed other Eisenhower supporters to use what influence they had in their hometowns on behalf of Ike, worked with the campaign's executive committee to disburse funds for advertising and promoting campaign events, and drove on icy roads night after night to spread the word about Eisenhower. On the stump, Adams used every argument for Ike he could conjure. His remarks at campaign rallies emphasized, for example, the frugality that Ike had grown up with and would assuredly practice in the White House. But he also talked about the dangers of Soviet communism and the need to elect a president wholeheartedly committed to defense of Western European democracy. Aware that his candidate was not in New Hampshire stumping for votes, Adams attempted to turn a liability into a virtue. When asked in a debate, "Where does Eisenhower stand on the issues of the day?" Adams adroitly parried, "He stands side by side with your absent sons on the Rhine or fighting on Korea's Heartbreak Hill. He stands between you and communism. He stands for all we hold precious in our hearts, freedom, decency, and faith in a new day for America and for all the world." Above all, Adams hit hard on Taft's vulnerabilities as a candidate, his lack of appeal to independents, and the need for Republicans to take back the White House, something they could do confidently only with Eisenhower. The opposition presses its case. Neither the national press nor the Taft campaign could fail to notice the efforts of the Eisenhower forces. Acutely aware that their best argument against Eisenhower was that the public did not know where he stood on the major issues of the day, Taft supporters lobbied earnestly to get their candidate into New Hampshire to meet the voters. Ambivalent about campaigning in a state where he was not sure he could win, Taft eventually agreed to a campaign tour just before the primary. Arriving on March 6, the Ohioan visited more than two dozen cities and towns in New Hampshire in a grueling 500-mile, three-day tour, accompanied by two busloads of national reporters. It was a fascinating tableau watching the dour senator meet and greet voters, something he clearly did not relish. Even one of his own campaign advisors, Robert Upton, called Taft a cold fish. Try as he might to connect with voters, Taft lacked the natural instincts of a modern politician. He hated baby kissing and publicity stunts like wearing Indian headdress or petting farm animals. Even smiles and small talk were not second nature for Taft. At a stop in Peterborough, he arrived at a diner where waitresses were eager to shake his hand. Taft was so intent on studying the speech he was going to give later in the day that he marched straight to a seat and, without looking up, demanded a cup of coffee and make it hot. Taft thereby forfeited the waitress vote. As the Peterborough Transcript editorialized in the wake of Taft's visit to a community that was viewed as a toss-up in the Republican vote, Taft failed to let the voters get the feel of him and sign autographs for the eager youngsters and oldsters whom he brushed by. Had he done so, he might have won some friends and influenced some people. Still, the senator's very appearance in New Hampshire contrasted with a campaign of surrogates for his main opposition. Then, as now, New Hampshire voters like meeting the candidate face to face, and whatever his deficiencies as a campaigner, Taft had done just that. He had asked New Hampshire citizens to give him their votes on primary day. That was more than his main rival had done. Moreover, Taft had punched back at his opponent's arguments that he was a weak candidate, pointing out that he had been elected repeatedly in the strong pro-labor state of Ohio, and that he offered a fighting campaign, not the kind of Me Too campaign he claimed Eisenhower would run against Truman. "They say Taft can't win," he said, "but I have always won." Nevertheless, as the national press converged on New Hampshire in the final 2 weeks before the primary, reporters increasingly viewed the result as anything but foreordained. Private polls reassured Adams that Ike was holding on to the lead he had established at the campaign's outset. Stassen's personal campaigning in New Hampshire posed little threat to Eisenhower, but no campaign manager could be oblivious to articles and national publications suggesting that the Taft visit might turn the tide in his favor. Taft's seeming momentum impressed even James Reston, the pro-Eisenhower political analyst for the New York Times, who visited what he called this politics-crazy state late in the campaign to take its measure. Taft, he wrote, was making progress in a state where General Eisenhower is about as well represented as anywhere in the nation. Moreover, unscientific surveys by various New Hampshire newspapers showed the race tightening to the point where it could go either way. For the Taftites, the formula for victory in New Hampshire was straightforward. Bring out a heavy vote in Manchester and the rural communities and keep within hailing distance of Eisenhower in places like Portsmouth, Nashua, Concord, Littleton, and Dover. Taft had never been especially popular with working-class voters. His bailiwick was rural and small-town America. Taft himself downplayed his chances, saying he would be happy to win 4 of the 14 contested delegates. But clearly, hope was growing in the Taft camp that an upset was possible. On election eve, Ted Johnston of Manchester, the key figure in the senator's New Hampshire campaign, predicted that Taft would win the popularity contest by 5,000 votes. Taft himself was quoted as calling the contest a horse race and saying that he expected to capture 4 or more of the state's 14 delegates to the national convention in July. Everyone grasped that an Eisenhower defeat in New Hampshire would undermine the entire basis for his campaign, namely that Ike was electable and Taft was not. That the race seemed to be tightening was evidenced by the increased decibel of the attacks on Taft that Adams and others unleashed in the final days of the primary campaign. Not until early March, for example, did Adams and other Eisenhower backers begin to criticize Taft as an isolationist who couldn't be trusted to conduct the nation's foreign policy in a dangerous world. Not until the final days of the campaign did Eisenhower forces deride Taft as a perennial office seeker and a machine Republican, as the Monitor's Langley put it in an editorial just before the primary vote. Tight contests bring out the heavy oratorical equipment, and by that measure, the GOP presidential race was anything but a walk for Eisenhower. A convincing victory. As primary day approached, Adams became increasingly concerned about the weather. But the wet snow and winds that he woke to on March 11 proved not to pose a major problem. Turnout was strong, in part because it was also town meeting day, and because the Democrats were also witnessing a spirited contest between President Truman and Tennessee Senator Estes Kefauver. By early evening, the voting pattern was clear. Kefauver had won a stunning upset in the Democratic primary, and in the GOP contest, Ike defeated Taft by a comfortable 5-4 margin. 46,661 votes for Eisenhower, 35,838 for Taft. Eisenhower carried every county, all but one of New Hampshire's cities, Manchester, and 138 of 223 towns, territory that, as one political analyst has put it, was considered Taft country. Adams was exultant. His hard work had made a difference. Senator Taft and his supporters could dismiss the result as something expected, given the Eisenhower camp's heavier firepower and financial advantage. But the fact remained. Eisenhower had demonstrated his appeal to voters in the first true test of public opinion in 1952. In Frankfurt, Germany, during the balloting, Eisenhower declared himself deeply moved by the outcome in New Hampshire. He soon cabled Adams, expressing his profound appreciation to the voters of New Hampshire, and especially to Sherman Adams. For his part, Adams interpreted the result as a call to Dwight D. Eisenhower to accept the nomination for the presidency of the United States. And Adams would not rest until he saw that call come to fruition. Sorting out the primary results, it seems clear that Robert Taft miscalculated in entering the New Hampshire primary. Taft had placed too much credence in hopeful rather than scientific polling and other counsel. He had failed to lower his supporters' expectations of a head-to-head contest there and failed to put everything he had into the campaign. But Taft's lack of 2020 foresight was perhaps less important than his own rather outdated campaign style and the sheer power of Eisenhower's popular appeal, combined with a powerhouse organization led by Sherman Adams. In the end, New Hampshire jolted, if not quite derailed, the Taft campaign for president. It launched a reluctant new star on the political scene and gave the man who had hitched his political future to that rising star a new opportunity for public service. In New Hampshire, the making of the president 1952 had taken a critical turn. As for Sherman Adams, he replied to reporters' repeated queries about what he would be doing in 1953 by saying he knew only that he'd be chopping wood. There was life indeed after the New Hampshire primary for Sherman Adams, and splitting wood was the least of it.
Michael Berkner is Benjamin Franklin Professor of Liberal Arts at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. His books include James Buchanan and the Political Crisis of the 1850s, published in 1996, and McCormick of Rutgers, Scholar, Teacher, Public Historian, published in 2001. He is currently completing a biography of Sherman Adams. You've been listening to First Stop, the New Hampshire Primary, a special issue of Historical New Hampshire, published in 2003 by the New Hampshire Historical Society. Historical New Hampshire, the only statewide history journal, has been a regular publication of the New Hampshire Historical Society since 1944. First Stop, the New Hampshire Primary, and the exhibition it accompanied were produced by the New Hampshire Historical Society in collaboration with the New Hampshire Political Library. The publication was dedicated to the late Governor Hugh Gregg, one of the leading advocates of New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary and founder of the New Hampshire Political Library. The audio version of First Stop was narrated by John Walters and produced by Jody Peterson at Cliff House Audio for the New Hampshire Historical Society. Music performed by Colin McCaffrey and Patty Casey. First Stop, the New Hampshire Primary, made possible with generous support from the Hugh Gregg Foundation.